Thank you very much for this challenging thought. We are getting some bar chairs to be more relaxed. Okay, so I have to now it's the time for Q&A, and I would like to start with one question that will display my immaturity or immatureness. Isn't being grown up something very much connected to resignate? I used to be like punk or something like this in my teenager time. Being grown up is such an unsexy idea.
yes, and there you can say so. It has not immediately an appeal, particularly not for the younger generation. Maybe that's why I also talk about that. That part of the job is to arouse the desire for that, to say, it looks really boring, or it looks like you have to resign from the energy of life, but it's actually the contrary. It's to refine that energy in order to make a good life together. But this is precisely the difficulty. So if I would simply say to my children, you have to be grow up, that kills it completely. But if you say, yeah, there is a world out there that is pretty complicated, and there are things that are pretty bad, and still it's a world worth being in. That you can say is what I think as educators we should keep trying to do, okay, even if we are frustrated ourselves about the world. But that's
okay. But one could conceive that learning is also making a world that is worth being into it, instead of growing into a world that is there and to whom you would adjust. I'm still in my teenager mode.
I think there is a problem with the word growing. So I'm still looking for other words to use, but mature has the same thing of becoming ripe over time, so that doesn't get away. The word I like best, or the phrase I like best, is a non-ego-logical way of existing. But that sounds very philosophical, but that's what it is about, that we are there as egos, and that's really important, but if that's all there is, then we end up killing each other and ourselves in the process. So that's where the challenge lies.
I would like to invite the audience to make questions.
Hi, yes.
Could I get a little bit more light in the path? Yeah. So we can see the hands raising. Yes, please. Yeah.
Great talk, thank you very much. I've heard quite a few talks at this conference, and the one thing that keeps bugging me is anybody actually listening? Are any governments or countries actually listening to these wonderful talks we've heard? What you're saying, I agree with. As a teacher, I don't know how I could implement that into the classroom on a day-to-day basis. So can you give me any examples of governments or countries that are listening to you, actually doing what any of the wonderful speakers are saying here in action, please?
So to start with, what do teachers do? I fear I have to quote the Nike slogan, just do it. It's really interesting that this is an insight I got from Foucault, where he says we can write huge books about where the limits of what we can do are, but the best way to see whether there are any limits is simply to do something, and then we'll see where the limits are. I was a very polite boy from the Netherlands, and then I moved to England, and then colleagues tell me, well, in England, you just do and you ask for forgiveness, whereas I had been told, oh, you have to ask permission before you can do something. So there is something there about where have we sort of lost just the possibility to do and then to see what is possible. But of course, a lot of the things that happen in education are not only framed by policy, but they're also policed by policy. So there are all kind of incentives and punishments that work around the way in which teachers can do their job, for example, or schools can do things. And that's a really problematic logic. And then you ask, are there any governments that I've already managed to turn around. Well, that's not how I see my work, but I do think it's important to keep making these arguments. And I see glimmers of hope. I was in Denmark yesterday, where the current government about 5 years ago said we need to turn education around and we need to turn it towards learning and purely measurable learning outcomes. And it's horrible, and most teachers think it's a big mistake. But I think within 5 years, even politicians are beginning to see that there is something wrong there. A politician was quoted who used the phrase the fascism of learning. So he was beginning to see that how Rogers talked about it in the past, what is the title of this book? Carl Rogers, so The Freedom to Learn. So what used to be the freedom to learn, what was liberating, has become, you can say, a new technology of policing and also self-policing. So I think even in Denmark, where the push is enormously hard from the government to get education into measurable learning outcomes, people are beginning to see this is not working. I do quite a lot of work in the Netherlands, where they've tried this for about 15 years. And over the past years, people at all levels in society, politicians, the school inspectorate, they're beginning to see that this has reached a limit and that it's not going to help. So there you see that the ship has met its end point and is turning around. So the school inspection is suddenly talking very differently about what do we actually do when we go to a school? What kind of conversation have we got about educational quality? And what's interesting in the Netherlands is also that teachers have stood up and said, wait a minute, who owns education? Is it politicians or teachers? And they say, it's our job and our field and we're going to take it back. So those are hopeful developments, and sometimes it's good if these ideas can contribute a language or some support, but I think looking at that can help a bit.
Yes, please.
Yeah, hello. It was a very interesting talk. I came in toward...
Yeah, sorry, yes. I thought there is a sound problem, but it is good. Oh. Yeah, please. Yeah.
I came in towards the end, so you might have addressed this at the beginning of your talk. You talked about taking individual desires and converting them into something that is desirable collectively. That obviously involves a process of questioning, placing values on desires, saying somebody's desires or certain desires are legitimate, others are illegitimate, some desires are commensurable, some desires are incommensurable, and obviously then we need to sort through those desires. You mentioned three different sort of categories. Liberty, solidarity, and equality. Depending on how you flesh out those concepts, you can have very different types of desires that are desirable collectively. Is there any way, or are there any suggestions that you would have for how to flesh out these concepts a little more to provide real sort of criteria for sort of sifting through different types of individual desires?
I think that's a very good question, and maybe 2 points in relation to that. That I mention equality and liberty and solidarity is in order to say democracy is not everything we want it to be. So democracy comes out of a history where these values, you can say, have become important in marking the place in which we figure out what we should try to desire collectively. What you also do, you give a brilliant description of what the democratic political process is, where we have to say, yes, some desires are not possible, some desires are illegitimate. That's the difficult work. And then you can say, we need to get deeper also in these values in order to figure out what they actually stand for. And of course, there we also find different definitions. I think what I've tried to say earlier in my talk is that we've lost sort of a good understanding of what liberty stands for. So when I talk about the freedom of shopping, that has become a trivial definition of liberty, where we think that my liberty has nothing to do with your liberty. So that's one of the things which some people call neoliberalism, that we need to regain in understanding what freedom actually is. The other quick thing to mention is that this talk has been quite ahistorical. And one important issue about desires is that desires also are historical. It comes back to the whole question of colonialism as well. We live in situations where the desires and the identities of some people have been completely eradicated, suppressed, have been made impossible. Out of that, you can say it's not just understandable that people want to make a claim for their identity as pure as possible, but it's also really important that in the historic dimension of our political thinking, we acknowledge that. But ultimately, and that's the theoretical point I make, if we all want our identity to exist 100% pure, that is impossible. So ultimately, we have to see that to have an identity can ever only be imperfectly. But where the balance lies, there we need to also have a historical awareness. We can't do that just by looking at sort of abstract philosophical concepts. So that may be as a response.
We will have more time in the final panel. We started a little bit late, but I would like to take one question.
Yeah.
And then we move on. Yes, okay. Please.
Thank you. Curious about, because it's hard for me not to read your presentation as an invitation for like more therapeutic approach in education, because desires are multiples and realities are in itself contradictory also. So what do you like, how do you imagine, if not learning, what kind of forms of education does educators have to go through to be able to get there, to get into that knowledge or like grown-upness that they could teach to students?
Yeah, that's a really nice question, whether educators need to, the quick way would be to say you can only be an educator when you're grown up. That's not how I see it, but I do think that as educators, this question of trying to exist in a grown-up way has to be a living question for you. So there is some work to be done also in teacher education to look at what actually are the desires that we bring to our job as teachers. Now, whether that's therapeutic, I'm not sure. I mean, it's a difficult discussion. I do think it's really important to distinguish education from therapy. Therapy is needed when there is something that needs to be mended or healed. And I start by saying to be a student is not a disease or not an illness. To be a student is to be a living human being in relation with other living human beings. So that's why the language of therapy, we have to be very careful, and why I think education as the place where we cannot just meet the real, but where we get time, but also forms that are helpful to figure out what that meeting means. That's why I want to have schools in beautiful buildings, if possible.
Thank you very much. So we are moving to the next round. That is going to take place immediately now, without an interruption. So I'm going to allow for a second, because I see there is the need to change the room. But yeah. Once you have settled down. We have been talking about the beautiful risk of education, and Gerd Biester stressed all the beauty that lies in the uncertainty of dealing with the world. And we are going to go on speaking. Thank you, Leila. That was telepathy. Speaking on complexity and the unknown. The next round is going to be a dialogue. We'll have on stage Luis Kamnitzer and Francisca Soliom. And I'm very pleased to introduce both of them before I ask them on stage. Luis Kamnitzer has a trajectory before becoming an artist that already shows all the complexities of the times we have been living in. He was born in Lübeck in Germany in 1937 and grew up in Montevideo, Uruguay, and there he attended the Montevideo School of Fine Arts, which I just heard yesterday was an anarchist school of fine arts, and this connects to other talks we have been having today, where he studied sculpture and architecture. After having had his first solo exhibition in Uruguay, he moved to New York in 1964, where he developed and practiced as an artist, as a writer, as a critic, as an educator, and as an art theorist that has become very important for the very idea of contemporary art and art education. And I'm doing no justice to his work by focusing on the art education aspect. He's a great conceptual artist. We'll have the pleasure to see an exhibition of his work in 2 years at Hamburger Bahnhof. A retrospective of his work is planned for next year at the Reina Sofia. Kathy Burke today quoted or described somebody as a gentle anarchist. I think that fits to Luis Kamnitzer as well. Luis Kamnitzer is going to be speaking with Francisca Soliom. I'm not really putting all the accents and sounds I should. She was born in Budapest, studied art history in Cologne and Paris, worked at the Ludwig Museum of Contemporary Art in Budapest, and became director of the Institute of Contemporary Art in Dunajavaros, Hungary, and I'm sure that's wrong. And since 2012, she's the director of the Gallery for Contemporary Arts, the Museum of Contemporary Arts, Leipzig. Among other great shows, she has curated creativity exercises and show on how people learn what they know and how it influences their personality. They are going to have a dialogue on stage, and I'm very pleased that both followed our invitation. Please, Luis, Francisca.